The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
In 2009, this is a year after the Russian intervention, the Russo-Georgian War in 2008. So in 2009, Hillary Clinton, who was the Secretary of State of the United States at the time, sat down with the Foreign Minister of Russia, Sergei Lavrov. Clinton presented the Russian Foreign Minister with a gift at the time. There's pictures of this, you can see them. The gift was a reset button meant to symbolize the rosy new course in their relations, now under the Obama administration. But it turns out inter-imperialist rivalries can't be reset at the touch of a button. A couple of weeks ago, NATO's B-52 bombers were dropping dummy bombs during military exercises less than 200 miles from the Russian border. Today, the words New Cold War are plastered across newspapers from New York to Berlin to Moscow. That reset button did end up betraying a much deeper truth, though. The Russian word for reset was mistranslated, and the actual word on the button meant, it was перегрузка, meant overcharged or overloaded. I think that's a much more appropriate characterization of imperialist system in which conflict is kind of built into it, despite the intentions of its leaders. So if you read the mainstream media in the United States, you may have distilled a kind of blurry picture of what's going on in Ukraine that looks something like this. The embattled new government of Ukraine is doing the best it can to carry out a modernization of a corrupt country, while Russian-backed separatists in the East are continuing to violate the hard-won ceasefire agreements. Obama, we're told, is making every effort to coax his European NATO allies to help the new leaders of the Ukrainian government in their heroic struggle, while long-dormant Russian imperial ambitions have reawakened, and the annexation of Crimea is only the first step in a sinister plot of the expanding Russian empire. In fact, in the West, we're presented with an image of Vladimir Putin as an evil, unscrupulous, and even delusional dictator bent on restoring the glory of Russia on the world stage. This depiction of the forces at play in Russia and Ukraine is, needless to say, completely false and unhelpful. This is a kind of mainstream framework that has led to a predominant conception of what's happening in Ukraine as basically an impenetrable mess. So my goal here is to provide a Marxist framework for clearing that up. I'm going to argue that the Ukrainian crisis and the civil war are products of an ongoing inter-imperialist rivalry between the United States, predominantly, and Russia, and that inter-imperialist rivalry is taking place according to a certain logic. The growing and increasingly bloody conflict is rationally understandable based upon the economic and social determinants that are fueling it. So that's the kind of factors that I'm going to forefront. Just to give you kind of an outline of where I'm going to go with this. First, I'm going to talk a little bit about the current state of the military conflict and where it came from. Then I'm going to get into the aggressive advance of U.S.-dominated neoliberalism on a global scale, along with, you know, that's riding the NATO tanks along the eastern border of Russia, or the western border of Russia. And then finally, I'm going to get into the internal contradictions of Russian capitalism that are compelling the expansion of its military and the domestic crackdown on rising dissent in Russia. Okay, so just to dive right into it. In the West, troops, weapons, and resources are being shifted to orient on Russia in the biggest reinforcement of NATO since the end of the Cold War. As part of its ramped up operations, NATO is stationing new land-based cruise missiles, heavy artillery, and tanks in at least six Eastern European countries, while military exercises in the region have increased substantially with thousands of troops mobilized for drills and patrols, including by air and by sea. Overall this year, NATO will complete over 300 exercises. That's triple what it was a mere 2 years ago. Washington has been accusing Russia of violating several of the historic treaties signed at the end of the Cold War by testing intermediate range cruise and ballistic missiles. NATO points to these alleged violations as grounds for ramping up their presence in Eastern Europe, along with rationing up military spending in NATO member states. So Obama is right now on a campaign to get all the European members of NATO to increase the percentage, the ratio of their GDP that they spend on the military. The European allies of the United States, especially Germany, are reluctant to go along with U.S.-led efforts to remilitarize the Baltic, even openly casting doubt upon the U.S. claims that Russia has violated the long-standing treaties. A recent Pew poll shows that the ambivalent approach of many European NATO countries toward defending other NATO members from the possible Russian attack is basically quite low. There's a large ambiguity about whether they're ready to defend their NATO fellow NATO allies. Despite this, in mid-June, the EU renewed economic sanctions on Russia, which was, of course, denounced by Putin. On the other side of the reforged Iron Curtain, Putin has promised a modernization of Russia's nuclear weapons, and in June he unveiled plans for 40 new intercontinental ballistic missiles. In the not-so-covert operations in eastern Ukraine, Russian improvised tactics combined traditional ground troop methods with the employment of mercenaries, volunteers, and cyber warfare. Some people have been calling this a hybrid war, but actually it's basically the same kind of conventional tactics of warfare that have been used for decades. The Maidan movement in late 2013, early 2014, began with hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians occupying the central square of Kiev in the dead of winter, protesting miserable living conditions under a corrupt and repressive regime. As the movement grew, so did its internal political contradictions, and lack of effective organization on the left yielded space to the traditional parliamentary opposition parties and even tightly organized neo-Nazi battle organizations like the Right Sector, which I'm sure people have heard a little bit about. By February 2014, when the mass movement succeeded in ousting President Viktor Yanukovych, the democratic aspirations of the majority of the Maidan became politically subordinated to the cynical maneuvering of a pro-Western bloc of Ukrainian oligarchs. The new bloc took control of the government, launched a so-called anti-terrorist operation against separatists in the east of Ukraine, and thus kicked off the civil war that has lasted until today. A civil war in Ukraine has already resulted in over 6,000 deaths, with only shaky promises and precarious ceasefires holding up more deaths. On the whole, the Ukrainians fighting the war were not initially driven by fanatical hatred, but rather concerned for their own well-being and their futures on both sides. As Volodymyr Yushchenko has pointed out in a recent article he wrote for New Left Review, I highly recommend it, quote, both the Maidan and the Eastern-based anti-Maidan, the movement that arose in the East that eventually developed into the separatist movement, both these protests were driven by a mixture of just causes and irrational fears, and both were ultimately channeled into a confrontation between competing and mutually reinforcing imperialisms, Western and Russia, and nationalisms, Russian and Ukrainian. So that brings us to today. Now I want to talk a little bit about Western imperialism in Ukraine since the Maidan brought this new bloc of oligarchs to power. So since coming to power, the nationalist neoliberal government of Ukraine has presided over a devastating civil war and a massive social attack on its own citizens. Despite negotiating what was called the Minsk II peace accord in February, fighting continues to flare up around many cities in the east of Ukraine. American soldiers are training Ukrainian troops to fight the separatists in the east, while the Ukrainian army struggles to restrain right-wing volunteer militias like the notoriously neo-Nazi Azov Battalion from violating the Minsk Agreement. Right Sector was the last of the far-right groups to be brought into the government fold, but now their leading figure, Dmytro Yarosh, has been appointed to an advisory position in the Ministry of Defense. Formerly, they were holding out to refusing to take any government positions. In further violation of the Minsk Accord, the government under Petro Poroshenko has been enforcing an economic blockade on the Eastern Separatist Republic since early June, refusing to pay pensions there and blocking trade. And so there's a real social basis for resentment and discontent with the Ukrainian authorities in the east of the country. But Western imperialism consists of much more than military aggression. As Ellen Meissens Wood has pointed out, some of the main functions of capitalist imperialism as it applies to the US are, quote, the imposition, maintenance, and enforcement of social property relations conducive to the exertion of economic power, the creation of a predictable social and administrative order of the kind that capitalism needs, end quote. In carrying out this agenda, U.S. imperialism and global capital depend upon local states to enforce these conditions locally. This is exactly what happened in the color revolutions in Georgia in 2003 and in Ukraine in 2004, and this is what's happening now in Ukraine after the Maidan. Introducing strictly enforced property relations into Ukraine opens up the Ukrainian market to Western multinational corporations, and these are ultimately the beneficiaries of Ukraine's economic assimilation into the West. U.S. imperialism is wreaking havoc on ordinary Ukrainians. As part of the neoliberal shock therapy imposed by the IMF loans, public sector pensions have been cut and consumer taxes have increased. The IMF-mandated drastic currency devaluations means that all imported goods are even more expensive for Ukrainian consumers. And this, combined with the soaring inflation, has meant that prices of consumer goods rose by 61% in April compared to the year before, while wages have not risen. Basic necessities like food and utilities have become almost unaffordable, and inflated medicine prices caused a catastrophic situation for people unlucky enough to need medical care last year. One of the most prominent reforms demanded by the IMF has been, and this has been one of the most devastating, to cut the subsidies for domestic gas use on household gas, which pushes significant energy costs onto working people whose salaries have effectively decreased in the rising inflation. Unemployment is also rising as the privatizations of state-owned companies are causing mass layoffs. The accelerated neoliberal restructuring in Ukraine has the character of a full frontal assault on the working class. The proposed new labor code will strip Ukrainian workers of basic protections like banning children from under three from working night shifts, which was part of the old labor code that's now getting torn apart. The proposed new laws create the conditions for further wage reductions as the only way to make Ukrainian firms competitive on the newly opened European market. On top of this, in its anti-Russian zeal, the Ukrainian government just passed laws banning all communist and Nazi propaganda. I'm sure some people have heard a little bit about this, which is effectively being used in reality to, you know, selectively enforce to make sure that no one ever talks about the class struggle, which would be automatically lumped in with communist propaganda. This is a familiar pattern, right? The IMF package is primarily channeled into bailing out the large Ukrainian banks and oligarchs who took over the government bonds, even while living standards are plunging. Since the regime change, there has been a reshuffling of the ruling class in Ukraine, with the balance of oligarchic power shifting from the mines of the East to the banks of the West. The banking magnate Ihor Kolomoisky is now the most powerful oligarch in Ukraine, just to kind of give an image of where the power has shifted to. Previously, it was the mining oligarch Akhmetov. The Ukrainian regime is aggressively trying to establish a neoliberal bastion against Russia, enlisting the help of former Georgian president and brutal austerity champion Mikhail Saakashvili to govern the Odessa region on the Black Sea. Having reached the point where Ukraine is flooded with weapons, it's difficult to de-escalate the situation there. Ukrainians view it as a kind of return to the 1990s, with massive inflation, high levels of violence, and uncertainty about the future. The aftermath of the Maidan demonstration has left the oligarch system intact, although now in alliance with U.S. imperialism. So to kind of synthesize that, the Western imperialist intervention in Ukraine, both military and economic, is driven by the need to expand the neoliberal global order in the service of Western multinational corporations. These are the people who are benefiting from the restructuring in Ukraine, along with a fraction of the oligarchs, the ruling class in Ukraine itself, who have material ties to the West. Okay, so talk a little bit about Ukraine and the restructuring that's going on there. Now I want to shift a little bit to Russia. So as in the distant past, Ukrainians continue to be subjugated to the economic and political pressures of their post-Soviet neighbor. Russian imperialism flows from the internal contradictions of Russian capitalism itself. The Russian social system has been variously described as authoritarian capitalism, oligarchic capitalism, or gangster capitalism, and I think for good reason. Corruption in Russia is not corruption in the sense that we normally understand it in the West, and this is kind of what I want to get into. I think people are a little bit less familiar with how capitalism works in Russia. So corruption is actually a structural feature of Russian capitalism. I'm going to spend a little bit more time on Russian capitalism for the simple reason that I think people are, you know, less familiar with it. So what I'm about to go through is largely drawing on our comrade in the Russian socialist movement, Ilya Matveyev, and the Russian economist who just released a book, Ruslan Zarasov. His recent book is called The Conundrum of Russian Capitalism. Okay, so in Russia, powerful individuals, the owners and managers within Russian corporations, big insiders is what Zarasov calls them, exhibit rather non-market behavior. In order to stake out market share and outmaneuver competitors, business in the United States and Europe, for example, are compelled to reinvest their profits in expansion and technological development, a process Marx called reproduction on an extended scale in another context. But instead of reinvesting profits for longer-term returns, Russian big insiders use their positions of control within their corporations to divert cash flows into shell corporations and ultimately private offshore accounts. For Russian corporations, profitability is measured not in terms of investments and productive assets, or like the differences between costs and returns, but rather in terms of the size of the financial flows and thus potential surplus that can be extracted from them for personal gain. This extracted sum is referred to as insider rent. Crucially, the change measure of profitability, the size of financial flows rather than like cost returns, this changed measure of how they measure profit changes the set of motivations for corporate strategies and economic decisions. According to capitalist market logic, businesses that do not invest should simply be forced out of the market by more efficient and innovative competitors. But the large Russian corporations maintain their dominant market positions, monopolies in many cases, by means of corruption and blunt force. Extra economic coercion is not an anomaly in Russia. And it's actually an entire self-perpetuating system. So how has this coercion been exercised? Each firm relies upon a strong infrastructure of control, able to secure opportunities for revenue extraction and more broadly to secure a firm's power over the market. The repertoire of this control infrastructure includes entrenched corruption, criminal gangs, raids and hostile takeovers, and networks of personal ties, bribery, including with the state. Pressured by competition, each firm is compelled to redirect a portion of the extracted insider rent not only to offshore accounts, but also in shoring up this infrastructure of control. By this means, large monopolies crowd out would-be competitors who lack sufficient corrupt connections and coercive support. The only way to challenge the power of the large monopolies would be through a more powerful infrastructure of control. But that structural imperative only incentivizes greater diversion of cash flows into cementing these networks of corruption and coercion. As a whole, there's certainly nothing groundbreaking about the use of such sundry stratagems, as Lenin called them. Lenin already analyzed them in 1916 in Imperialism. But a peculiar feature has evolved in the contemporary Russian version. At the core of this system is the separation of ownership and control, where control over cash flows effectively makes ownership insignificant. This dissolves any qualitative differences between insider rent processes in private corporations and the same processes in state-owned, on the basis of state property. State managers and officials are thus allowed, even incentivized, to function as oligarchs, even when the state technically owns the corporation. Indeed, the most effective infrastructure of control is provided by the sprawling repressive state apparatus itself. The predominance of this state of affairs today in Russia is undeniable. Immense capital flight from Russia, currently estimated at $7 billion per month, has been a consistent structural phenomenon over the last 20 years, with 95% of Russian big businesses registered in offshore accounts. The short-term economic horizon generated and enforced by this system has led to the productive infrastructure, the capital stock in Russia, stagnating due to lack of investment, with the average age of machines in Russian industry exceeding 20 years compared to less than 10 years in the Soviet era. Despite significant efforts at market liberalization in many sectors, business confidence in the Russian Federation has been consistently pessimistic over the last decade. Not only do corruption and deep-seated coercive business methods keep out smaller competitors, they also often ward away larger foreign investment, which is seen by some people in the Russian government as one of the last options available to increase infrastructural investment. So in short, Russian capitalism has been sabotaging its own future. This situation creates some unique problems for the ruling class in Russia, so now that's what I'm going to talk about a little bit. Since 2000, Putin has presided over the consolidation of a system that I've just described, along with a well-managed balance of forces assembled in his governing team. The most notable component of this ensemble are a band of moderate pro-market reformers from St. Petersburg, and these pro-market reformers are kind of grouped around the former finance minister, Alexei Kudrin, along with, on the other hand, the securocrats, or siloviki. And this group of people is a former or current police or military personnel who push for the consolidation of political and economic control within a highly centralized state, which itself is buttressed by large, well-financed security and defense apparatuses. It was the latter group, the Siloviki, that has constituted the primary force in the state transformation under Putin since 2000. The Siloviki seek to counteract the self-cannibalizing tendencies of Russian oligarchic capitalism by expanding the role of the state in the economy, leading to nationalization of whole industries, especially in the energy sector. So this kind of works like, if you can't incentivize investment by private capitalists, you just take over the whole industries as a state, and then you can control where that investment goes. Significantly, Putin's ascent to power coincided with a sharp rise in oil prices after 2000, providing much-needed economic stability for a country emerging from severe crisis. The new normal created under Putin's leadership was, in class terms, the hegemony of the Siloviki in alliance with the oligarchs in state positions, though the ruling bloc also contained the St. Petersburg economic reformers in a subordinate position. However, far from reversing the plunder of the Wild East 1990s under Yeltsin, this stabilization was above all a consolidation, a solidification of the formation that had emerged in the previous tumultuous phase. In the woefully inefficient Russian oligarchic system, the bloated state apparatus is primarily used not for social services, but rather to expand the military and reinforce oligarchic profit extraction. This apparatus is the material basis for Siloviki power. Putin's state-centered model of capitalism under the hegemony of this group, the Siloviki, has a crucial weakness, though. It's dependent upon sustained oil revenues from exports. Without significant reinvestment, there's severely limited internal mechanisms for infrastructure renewal, funding social services, or even paying public sector salaries. Instead, the state has relied on the wellspring of oil exports for its economic lifeblood. When the oil revenue dries up, as it rapidly has since the end of last year, when oil prices plunged, oligarchic capitalism becomes unsustainable, mired with long stagnant capitalist stock and no path towards growth because it's, of its shallow integration into the global economy, the lack of opportunities for foreign investment like I was talking about. This has led to a contradictory imperatives for the state. On the one hand, it's increasingly dependent upon private and foreign investment for infrastructure renewal, which requires the enforcement of rigorous property rights in the private sector. On the other hand, the bloated military and state apparatus diverting revenues from reinvestment is necessary to keep the ruling class in power, this alliance under the hegemony of the Siloviki. This is manifested in two rival blocs engaged in a soft contest for hegemony over Russia, even while both control key levers of the state. On the one hand, the energy oligarchs and the Siloviki, who depend upon the expansive state to secure their profits and their jobs. But on the other hand, what we would consider more orthodox neoliberals, economic reformers with their base in finance, who view the streamlining of the state apparatus and the effective enforcement of reliable property rights as increasingly necessary to break out of the impasse of Russian capitalism. At the moment, the Western-style neoliberals still lack social and economic power in Russia. While the current recession and low oil prices provide fertile ground for the rise of the economic reformers like Kudrin, it leaves Putin and his system with little capacity to adapt and will only increase the de facto reliance on military options to combat threats to their power. The most significant such threat in recent years has come from the Maidan and the subsequent realignment of the Ukrainian economy, which was predominantly in the east, in the manufacturing sector, linked to Russian capitalism. So now it's been realigned towards the European Union, or is in the process of realignment. So that's what's happening. One of the main engines of Russian imperialism is the economically rooted contradiction in its ruling class. Neoliberal attacks upon the specific form of Russian state-centered capitalism, this oligarchic capitalism that I've been describing, are direct attacks on the rule of the oligarchic class and their entire mechanism of capital accumulation. The two interests directly conflict with one another. The strict, streamlined enforcement of property rights required by neoliberalism is fundamentally incompatible with the burgeoning network of corruption and control required by Russia's insider rent system. Yet in the context of falling oil prices and economic stagnation, these two interests are constantly driven to clash over diminishing resources and control of the state. At the heart of Russia's imperial outbursts, then, is already to be found an imperial rivalry, driven ever further by the advance of US-dominated neoliberal regime. So I've just covered kind of what it means for imperialisms to compete on an economic level, but there's another significant factor driving Russian imperialism specifically, and that's domestic social antagonisms. The Russian state is dependent upon the maintenance of a certain level of economic activity for survival. Like every capitalist country, it has a minimum requirements for growth. Achieving growth in this is a necessary goal of any state in order to finance itself through taxation and borrowing, but also in order to maintain public support for the regime. If a recession sets in with rising unemployment and shortages, the state confronts the real risk of social unrest. Continued oligarchic kickbacks and favors combined with the very low oil prices, the economic recession, and Western sanctions has taken its toll in Russia. Wages are stagnant or even withheld entirely as inflation this year has reached 16%. 11% of the population is now living below the poverty line in Russia, while according to one poll, 47% of people think of themselves as the working poor. This is a sharp increase from just 4 years ago when 80% of the population considered themselves to be middle class. Confronted with this situation, the Kremlin is resorting to non-economic means of shoring up support, including, most relevantly, by whipping up xenophobia and nationalist support for an imperial war. It's true that most Russians are dissatisfied with the state of affairs in Russia, but right now they tend to blame it on the drop in oil prices and Western sanctions rather than their own government. Indeed, a year after the annexation of Crimea, Putin's approval rating stood at 86%. These are some of the highest approval ratings he's had. The deflection of popular discontent from the oligarchs around the state energy corporations in Russia is intimately bound up with the nationalist fervor sparked by the Ukrainian war. In March 2014, 2 days after the referendum in Crimea, Putin addressed the Russian parliament. In the speech, he not only announced the annexation of Crimea, he also famously asserted the existence of a fifth column inside of national traitors within Russia. He thereby inaugurated a new turn in Kremlin strategy for social cohesion. Whereas loyalty and complacence in his first two terms was underpinned by substantial influx of oil revenues and continually rising wages in the public sector especially, this happened especially during the economic crisis of 2007-2008, now, the obvious inequalities in Russian society would have to be patched with this kind of flood of nationalism. This new course has been almost too effective in Russia. The murder of a prominent opposition figure and militant neoliberal, Boris Nemtsov, in February of this year is symptomatic of the situation in Russia. Nemtsov's murder, right outside the Kremlin, exposed Putin and his team as the sorcerer's apprentice, unable to control what they had conjured up. In March, a St. Petersburg forum hosted 150 representatives of European far-right parties, including the British National Party, the National Democratic Party of Germany, and Golden Dawn. This is only the capstone of the rise of the radical right in Russia, which is fueled by anti-Ukrainian propaganda, the proliferation of radical nationalist organizations, and returning soldiers who had fought in the Donetsk People's Republic and the Luhansk People's Republic. The far-right's heightened profile is also constraining the Kremlin's room for maneuver, even if it has taken measures against some of the most extreme of these groups. Putin's vertical of power is unraveling. Things can no longer function as they have. The requisite resources are dwindling, and the fight over those resources is intensifying. In these very unstable conditions, what happened in Ukraine threatens to set a powerful political example: mass protests bringing down a seemingly all-powerful corrupt regime. That's why in Russia, police repression of protests escalated drastically in the wake of the Maidan movement. The crackdown extends to organizations of civil society, such as independent election monitors and polling centers like Levada, which was one of the most the largest independent polling centers in Russia. Any organization receiving donations or funding from abroad are forced to register as foreign agents and are often subject to raids and closures. Then there's, of course, the law prohibiting LGBT propaganda to minors. The rapid passage of these laws and an avalanche of similar repressive legislation has led many Russians to call their state Duma the mad printer. So the goal of all this legislation and this crackdown is to create a kind of a web of legislation that can then be used to entrap dissidents, justify arbitrary arrests, and crack down on anyone opposed to the Kremlin. Revolutionary socialists in Russia and Ukraine face particularly difficult challenges. A history of Stalinist state capitalism has completely discredited socialism in the eyes of most Russians, robbing the Marxist left of the very language of class struggle. The opposition movement in Russia is mostly led by pro-Western professionals, sometimes openly neoliberal and calling for more austerity, more rigorous austerity. But that description by no means characterizes the masses of people who show up to the demonstrations. These people are usually young, educated, middle-class dissidents, though they're motivated more by issues like freedom of speech, transparency, democracy, than by economic and social problems. As Russian socialist Ilya Budryatskis has asserted, the difficult task of the Marxist left in Russia is to take part in these liberal demonstrations, but to expand them by constantly placing the social question at the center, talking about inequality and pushing back against austerity. The Kremlin's grip on power is not about to loosen, but the internal instability in Russia is not without its consequences. A small wave of wildcat strikes demanding unpaid wages broke out in April. Auto workers, metallurgical workers, and teachers went on strike, while space workers demanded wage arrears by painting messages on the roofs of their dormitories. You can see these aerial pictures of give us back our back wages printed on these dormitories. Despite their limited economic aims, these strikes are significant because they're not concentrated in the large cities, but rather in the very regions where the bastion of support for the Kremlin has traditionally come from. Okay, so just to step back a little bit. In Ukraine, the United States continues to fund extreme right military units, and the far right occupies top positions within the state security apparatus. Russian-backed separatists in the east continue the work of Russian imperialism, even against some of the protests of eastern Ukrainians. Very small, but they're emerging. Today, the immediate threat to Ukrainian working people, indeed to all working people, is undoubtedly the advance and consolidation of Western neoliberal imperialism. But that imperialism doesn't exist in a void. It's competing with another form of capitalist imperialism in a mutually reinforcing confrontation over which group will eventually reap the profits of exploitation in Ukraine. According to a recent, one of the better recent eyewitness accounts of on the ground in Ukraine, right now the general mood is one of anxiety and anger, especially at the draft, the conscription. There's a resentment of the government and a sense that it's either incompetent or just doesn't care about ordinary people on whom most of the burden of the civil war and the restructuring has been shifted. What the future holds for the working classes of the post-Soviet realm will be determined by the direction of anti-government protests and the ability of the left to be a force determining them. This is equally applicable whether demonstrators are opposing the corrupt oligarchy of Russia or the Western-backed neoliberal regime in Ukraine. On June 15th, the Ukrainian trade union confederations organized protests around Ukraine demanding the restoration of affordable household gas prices, repayment of back wages, and the creation of a job program for the youth, along with increase of public sector pay. For this, the trade union leaders are now facing repression by the state security apparatuses. On the same day, a rally in Donetsk brought out 500 people against the war, criticizing both the Ukrainian and the separatist authorities. despite the firm decision of the president, as he described it, to enforce a blockade against eastern republics, the Ukrainian government is having difficulty controlling ordinary Ukrainian citizens, restraining them from bringing groceries across the borders to their brothers and sisters in eastern separatist republics. Particularly inspiring is the recent foundation of a new party on the Ukrainian left, with activists and sympathizers in almost every major city of Ukraine. This party comes out of the left opposition during the Maidan. It opposes both Western and Russian imperialism and is working with the trade unions to build a social movement against all the oligarchs. For anti-imperialists in the West, our first responsibility is to oppose and work against the imperialism of the IMF, the EU, and the United States. So concretely, we should be organizing protests and supporting protests against NATO and the IMF policies. But the ongoing rampage of Western imperialism doesn't magically absolve the Kremlin of its crimes against our side, and Putin is no ally in the fight against capitalist imperialism. The supposedly anti-imperialist campus worldview that would say that he is an ally is tempting because it's simple. Divide the world into good and bad, and then unconditionally support any and everything that opposes U.S. imperialism, shedding any qualms we might have about the brutal character of some of these regimes. Situations like Ukraine, where in reality neither side of the war is good or progressive, this is the most consoling solution. But this kind of politics does nothing to facilitate the emancipation of the working class. On the contrary, it provides supposedly leftist cover to the enemies of workers, like Putin and his oligarchic system. As revolutionary socialists, our task is something different. We aim to build independent working class forces that oppose all imperialisms. 40 years of neoliberalism and ruling class offensive have placed severe restraints on that project. But in the words of Katerina Principe, the historical responsibility of the left is to disrupt such constraints, not to approach politics as a negotiation of the possible within existing bounds, but to make possible what is necessary. An independent revolutionary socialist movement in Russia, in Ukraine, in the EU, in the United States, that's what's necessary if we're ever going to see a better world. And that's the kind of international movement that we have to start making possible today.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.